Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, as always, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is serial entrepreneur Mark Fuccio. Did I pronounce that right?
Fuccio.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hello, John. Good to be here.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. I think we got to know each other better when you and I were doing fairly frequent appearances on Chuck Joyner's Mac Voices.
Yes, I think we had a number of runs there where we were on the show every 6 months or so. So between the show and then the pre-show and post-show chatting, we got to know each other a little bit.
Yeah, that was fun. Do you think he was making an effort to pair us up maybe?
Chuck seems to be a great mixer of people. So yes. I don't think there's anything explicit. It's just part of what he does.
Yeah, I've always had that feeling. I had Chuck Joyner on the show a while back on Background Mode, and that was a lot of fun. I like turning the tables on podcasters and hearing about their stories in the background, and it was a fun show with Chuck. Yeah. But I want to talk about you.
Oh, I feel so honored.
So we were talking yesterday about how you started off as a double E at MIT. I'm awed. I'm so impressed.
So it was a great school. It's a great education. You know, given where I am now, I kind of think it was misspent youth. but I really did. You know, I guess, you know, looking back on it all these years, the benefit is of an MIT education really is twofold. Number one, it teaches you how to learn new stuff, you know, at a high level. And then also at the same time, you know, their courses are very problem set oriented. It teaches you how to grunge it out and all the low level detail to actually, you know, produce and work and, you know, solve things and design things. So, you know, that's just an ongoing mark. I think it's probably left on me as well as other alum that, you know, it's a unique way of thinking and learning.
Yeah, I know it helped me a lot in my career. I worked on a PhD in astrophysics, and that level of work does sort of create a certain mindset, technical awareness, and, as you said, approach to problem solving. That's why physicists are sought after as problem solvers and software engineers, in fact.
That is true. I mean, there was, you know, all the Wall Street and the rise of quantitative finance was all driven by physicists. What was his name? Derman, originally at Goldman Sachs. And, you know, because they were the guys, right, who had all the knowledge of quantum mechanics and stochastic processes and stochastic calculus. And, you know, the only place that seemed to have any real application for it was Wall Street and finance.
Yeah, I don't know if that did us a lot of good or not in the long run, because computers are doing a lot of buying and selling very quickly.
Yeah. As with most things, you know, there's both good and bad from every new technology.
So what were you doing? So you got your bachelor's degree. Was it bachelor's in double E?
Yes.
So what happened right after that? Did you just go right to work?
I did. I sort of had an entrepreneurial bug, and I was also very interested in, you know, computer-aided design of integrated circuits. You know, way back when, I had visited Xerox PARC in the late 70s and saw the Alto, and, you know, just blown away. I mean, literally, it just left a very rich impression that this is the computer of the future. And
was the Alto the father of the Xerox Star?
Yes.
And, you know, and the Xerox Star is what Steve Jobs and was it Tesla? Larry Tesla saw when they came out?
No. I believe they saw the Alto, which was, you know, a bit sliced ECL. Oh. This is in the late 70s, because they tried to, you know, productize the Star, but I think that was around 82 or 83, I think. Mm-hmm. Well in the development of the original Mac.
Oh, interesting, because everybody talks about how it was the Xerox Star with its mouse and windows and icons on the screen that got Steve's attention.
Okay, I think I'd describe history a little bit slightly differently.
You're the expert. You worked there.
So anyway, that really left a change on me. So I joined Philips Research Labs in Briarcliff Manor, New York, in large part because they were going to be doing CAD work, and there was a company that was productizing. I'm not sure if it was the Alto or if they did a compatible version. This company is called Three Rivers Corp in Pittsburgh, and got it and did a lot of graphics and graphics library work. Wrote variety of packages to display waveform analysis results that were spit out by the SPICE circuit simulator.
Exactly.
It's one of the mainstays of the industry. After a year there was a little bit of shift of where they wanted to focus their priorities, and socially I was unhappy. It's a great place, but it wasn't a place for a single person. Despite on a whim just taking an hour drive into Manhattan to go and have a dinner or something. So I ended up joining a startup in Silicon Valley, and that's where I've been ever since.
What was the startup?
It was a Gene Amdahl startup to make an IBM 360 compatible mainframe. It was his third venture at that. The original he did at IBM, then Amdahl Corp, and this was called Trilogy Systems. And it was famous in its day because it had raised about $425 or $35 million of capital. It was going to be pioneering, trying to do wafer scale integration. But Gene and company bet on the wrong technology. Instead of building on MOS low power, they were doing ECL, and they pulled a lot of things together. It was miraculous. It was sort of like a Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. New power supply, new packaging, new cooling, new CAD tools. But ultimately, they never got the wafer scale working. So, as typical Valley fashion, it sort of repivoted, and they did a tremendous pull of people and talent into the Valley from all over the U.S. and Canada, and those people just scattered and hit the winds and went on like people do in the Valley.
That happens. That happens. I remember, I think it was New Mexico State had an Amdahl that I had used for a while. Yeah.
Right. Very interesting machines.
I remember they were going to put another megabyte of RAM into the Amdahl. They had 1 megabyte, and they wanted to buy a second megabyte of RAM, and it was mm-hmm. $500,000.
Right. I remember one project I was involved in was doing a design rule checking of the mask layout patterns, and I think I had a gigabyte worth of storage. And if you look at it, they were IBM. I think at that time, I think they had these 16-inch magnetic disks, and they were all stacked up into a thing the mm-hmm. size of basically a washing machine. It's bigger than an under the counter dishwasher, and there were 10 of them in a row, and that was a gigabyte.
I had those connected to a VAX PDP 1170 at White Sands. It was about the size of a washing machine, maybe a little smaller. Had 170 megabytes each. We had three of them.
And now the Safari on my iPhone wastes more space than its cache.
Good times. So what happened after Amdahl?
Amdahl, I went to another electronic design automation company called Daisy Systems. Was there for a while, then went to Silicon Graphics, again, sort of.
Oh, wow. One of my favorite companies.
Graphics, this recurring graphics theme.
You've worked for some giants. I'm in awe.
I did. And, sort of by the mid-90s, I sort of got burned out on large companies and, jumped ship. I did some consulting for a year, and then another fellow who I actually had met
Slow down. I want to talk about SGI. So I had an SGI Indy at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and it was an awesome, awesome computer. And it was big and beautiful and blue and had a camera on top. And you knew the designer of the Indy, didn't you? We were talking the other day about that.
Yeah, I knew some of the people in the design group. SGI was very heavily divisionalized. You know, they had ASD, you know, the high end Onyx and others, you know, stuff $100,000 or more.
Oh yeah, we used an Onyx at Lockheed Martin.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah, then I was in the personal systems division, so that was basically anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000. And, you know, I was running a business unit where we were taking the technology, rolling them into, industry standard board, form factor, so-called, VME form factor, and we're selling them to systems integrators. We had an MRI company that was using this, had some companies in Scandinavia that were making flight or more appropriately sort of training as well as simulation systems for all the ferries. Because you can imagine going around the fjords in Norway, mm-hmm. It's dark and there's cloudy, that you need to have a good training as well as you need to have a good system to really position where you are. So basically the idea there was, integrate it into a larger electronic system and provide the graphical user interface.
IRIX.
Yes.
What was cool about the IRIX at the time, as I recall, was that Apple was in a bit of trouble in the 90s because they had this ancient operating system, System 6, System 7, Mac OS 8, which didn't have a great underpinning. It wasn't memory protected. It didn't have reentrant code. You didn't have symmetrical multiprocessing. It was just a mess. And as we know from history, Apple was scrambling to, get a new operating system. And I talked to, who was it the other day about that? So if you had an SGI at the time, SGI had this beautiful graphical interface that was different than CDE on, say, Sun or AIX. And it was like the Mac in spades, and you could sense that they had something great, and it was Unix. I think IRIX was ATT System 5, right?
System 5, that's right.
Right, and so you had this beautiful Unix operating system on a cool workstation with a Mac-like operating system with icons and a GUI and a great browser, and you kind of felt like, if SGI did it right, they could put Apple out of business. But then, as we know, it went the opposite way. SGI failed for other reasons. Apple got a new operating system and Steve Jobs in the process. And the whole thing reversed.
That's right. It was really interesting. I mean, SGI, they made a little bit of strategic mistake, thinking, succumbing to all the Windows NT pressure.
Yeah.
So it came out.
Windows NT on a IRIX workstation. It just seemed so non-sequiturish.
It's insane.
Well, wasn't it because SGI hired this guy from Microsoft, and NT was all the rage, and this Microsoft guy said, look, if you want to sell more workstations, get rid of IRIX and put NT on it, you'll get rich.
That's right. And that was around the time I left, because I figured, okay, this company, its origins and all its values and everything, you just can't do a brain transplant like that.
Yeah.
It didn't work. And, I think they also made a strategic. So as part of that, what happened is this was when Intel started the megahertz and gigahertz wars, right? They just put pedal on speed. And, SGI had acquired MIPS in the early 90s, MIPS computer, and they basically used it for the MIPS chipset, fabulous RISC processor. But Intel caught up, and third party graphics companies caught up. So it's differentiated advantage. It just sort of lost out to the mainstream of the market.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is just, relatively speaking, it was doing relatively low volume compared to, the hundreds of millions of PCs.
Right.
I think we're seeing a similar thing. 10 years later, Sun succumbed to the same pressure, and they sold themselves to Oracle. And oddly, Apple benefited. They got off of the dead end of PowerPC chips, and they get on to the Intel processor in 2006, I guess.
Five or six.
Chip.
Yeah. Well, what was cool about this was that SGI didn't lay you off. You decided to leave on your own, had a different vision, and you just took off.
That's right. You know, we had at that time there was a lot of startups and very interested in doing it. And another fellow and I had met, Daisy, and also actually, he was also an MIT undergrad, but we didn't know each other there. But I think we had a lot of commonality of how we think about things. Although, it was a great partnership because, we just looked at problems and situations completely differently. But it was very complementary and truly 1+1=3 sort of engagement. And one of the things we're both sort of trying to deal with is what happens? Why do companies make dumb mistakes? How do they start successfully and then make dumb mistakes? And so the things we were groping with is, markets change and, and maybe successful companies sense that, and are able to change and shift, and, others, all they know is one trick and that's all they do. And, they have a predictable rise and fall. So, we set about building a consulting company to help answer two key questions. The first is, where's the sweet spot, for my technology in the market? And there's many variants of this, such as, what is my product roadmap? How do I price things? Out of all of these things, which things should we do first? But they all touch on making sure that is the startup trying to address a problem that is important as measured by people willing to spend money to solve it? Because there's that old sales expression, no pain, no sale. If it's not important, they're not going to spend time on it. So we built a practice between us over the next about 8 years. We're dealing mostly with startups, although we'd have larger established companies that were maybe interested in getting into new markets. And we dealt with semiconductor, EDA design tools, IP. We dealt with networking hardware, and then a little smattering of enterprise software, and a couple storage things, and other projects like that.
I was talking to Bob Levitis a while back. He worked in advertising for a while, and you tend to think of advertising, especially video commercials, is a client comes in and says, here's our product, here's our customers, here's how we'd like to present it. But sometimes it's not that way. Sometimes Bob would sit down with a customer and he'd say, well, what's the most important thing to know about your product? What's the key design? What's the core issue? What's the fundamental here? And they'd say, we don't know. We just want to sell a lot of them. And so it would be up to Bob to figure out what the product was and what the customer interest was and where the pain level was. And then he would do these ads that was the summation of his experience, short as it was, trying to understand the client's product. And sometimes they'd say, oh, yeah, that nails it. And sometimes they'd say, no, we don't like that. Do it over. It was frustrating.
Yes. I can imagine that because for about 3 years, we had a good relationship with a fellow on the East Coast who was running a marketing agency, service agency. And he was coming into a lot of startups in the RTP area and as well as Boston. And he'd refer people to us because they're startups, they're young people, they had seemingly had great ideas, but they had no focus. And by that, it's maybe the Bob Levitis story you're just talking about. The lack of focus is they really don't understand who is the customer and which is the problem that they're going to solve. So we did probably about a dozen research projects with this fellow and some of his startups, just to help them. And what we find actually interesting about entrepreneurs is they're very intuitive people, they typically may have an idea and they think, people are going to buy this because of A, B, and C.
Yeah, because it's so cool and we're so smart and people would just love this.
Right. Yeah. And reality, what you find out is, forget A, no one cares about it. B is interesting sometimes, but really it's C with, you know, E and F. Those are the real things that touch on the problem that they have. So most of it is, it was, you know, we were in that era just helping people shift and, you know, correct courses. Now, since then, venture world has changed a couple of times. So now when you hear people talk about pivot, it's something about our language, you know, that it sounds like that's a good thing, but no, pivot means you failed and you're taking a redirection.
Right,
you know, failure isn't necessarily bad, but you know, it's, a lot of this can be figured out, you know, up front, you know, before you spend, you know, lots of money and launch into the marketplace.
Mark, it's time for a break.
Certainly. Go make some money.
Yeah. So we're going to hear a little short commercial. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. We'll continue the discussion with Mark Fuccio, and we'll get into Drobo and some other cool stuff. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm talking with Mark Fuccio, serial entrepreneur, business analyst, marketing expert. Cool. So let's move on to the Drobo days.
Okay.
How did you fall in with Mr. Burrell?
Okay, so in the late 90s, you know, my business partner Dave Millman and I were in San Diego Airport. I forget, either going in or out on one of the shuttles, and we got this call, and you know, one thing led to another, and you know, it was from a startup in the UK that we knew one of the principals from a prior project for another UK company. And Jeff was one of the co-founders and CTO at that venture. You know, it ultimately, you know, we did a number of product roadmap and validation and other studies for them. They ultimately, you know, formed and moved into the U.S. As Blue Arc Corporation, and that was, you know, building very high-end performance network attached storage systems. They designed a couple ASICs, one for running the TCP/IP stack to make it really fast, and the other for running the Samba stack at the back end. And you know, that launched, and after, you know, several years in the market, it was ultimately acquired by Hitachi Data Systems. So that's how I met Jeff. As you know, things, you know, go up and down, and people move about, and we just stayed in touch. We just had a good chemistry with each other. During the sort of recession of 2002 or so, you know,
that's another important point for the listeners. First, build your infrastructure, get to know people, build a network, follow your vision, follow your passion, and there'll come a time when somebody you know has a magic partnership with you.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely very, very, very true. You know, relationship, you know, if you think about it competitively, technology changes very, very rapidly, you know, every 18 months to, you know, 3 years or so. But personal relationships, they change the slowest. I mean, people form relationships and, you know, they'll last, you know, long time, decades, or even a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So anyway, back to Jeff. So during the sort of slow period in the, you know, 2002-03 timeframe, what I had done is I had raised some angel money, and you know, we were having an idea of building a parallel Verilog simulator. So again, it's EDA, trying to parallelize it to improve performance.
EDA, fill us in.
EDA, electronic design automation.
Okay.
So you know, it got going, and after a while, we're getting results, and we're able to show that we can get acceleration. You know, we called it superlinear, meaning above the line, because you could literally, the way some of the algorithms and things work, if you add four processors, you could get more than 4x performance improvement. Ultimately, at some point, decided to shutter the venture because there's some problems within the team, and having been involved for a couple of years with sweat equity and forgoing things, it just seemed that it was just the cost was just too much. So I started to send some resumes over to Jeff, and he said, "Oh, well, why are you sending these to me, mate?" And I told him what's going to do, and he said, "Oh, well, I'm on a new venture. Let's meet and have breakfast." So we did, and the company was then called Trusted Data, which got renamed as Drobo, or Data Robotics, when it launched. And I consulted for them for about 6 months, and the team there loved me, and I loved the technology. So after 6 months, on New Year's Eve of 2005, I joined and became a full-time employee of Drobo.
What was your job title?
What was my job title? I held a variety there. I think at that time it was a director of product management.
Cool. So you got to sort of set the customer expectations and the user interface, right?
Yeah. So some of that was baked, and to fine tune some of the ideas. So again, Jeff and I had a very great relationship from the work we had done together at Blue Arc. Really, he could see the benefit of validating your assumptions with customers. That internally, people have great ideas, but ultimately, if it's not something that solves a problem that they'll buy, those are the ideas you really want to get, and those are the tests you want to apply when you look at there's five different ways or two different ways of doing something. So early on, we did an enormous amount of research about just the basic concept of something that's simple and expandable, and we did one survey, one of many, where basically we probed for attitudes towards storage. And you asked, do you want something that connects directly to your Mac or PC, or do you want something on a network? And the results were, about 72% versus 18% people wanted direct attach, either FireWire or USB. Oh, that's very interesting.
That is interesting.
And that structure has changed forever. I mean, the NAS, everyone talks about NAS, and the thing about NAS is it's over-competitive, and they've driven down prices, tremendously compared to the direct attached units. But anyway, the other thing as a startup trying to validate the idea was, okay, would people really buy this? How will it fare against single drives? So we constructed...
How did people feel about the management of the device? And use of a GUI to understand it, look at its storage levels, check its health and state.
I'll come to that. So sure. what we had done is conducted basically a buying exercise of do you want a single drive, a multiple drive system, where basically they're fixed storage, or do you want something that has multiple drives so that the storage can increase? And then we saw the preferences, put prices for it, asked them to select what they want. And then just had them select and show them the real price, and asked which one they would select. We were blown away that 42% would go from a product priced at $200 to one priced at $499. And the reason was they valued the expandability and safety. This was done. We had like 1,200 responses in the survey, balanced across all sorts of different segments. So we knew right then and there that the durable product would be a hit, that there was real strong demand and hunger for it in the marketplace.
How did you pick these candidates, these 1,200 people, and how did you sort of satisfy yourself that this was a good sampling?
Okay, so for most things, for most consumer research, the general rule of thumb is we want a couple hundred people. We were segmenting because we were looking very carefully at, you know, sort of prosumers, you know, sort of advanced amateurs or very sophisticated, you know, small businesses.
Did you buy a mailing list from someone, or did you use...
Yes. There's a whole infrastructure of so-called panel companies that would sell you. You know, we worked with a company is then called eRewards. It's now it's grown and it's changed its name to Research Now in Texas. And what they will do is, you know, their model, and it was originally, I believe, one of their founders, you know, invented the frequent flyer program at American. Or maybe it was United. And the idea was, okay, we'll compensate people for participating in market research, and we'll do it at roughly the rate of $100 or an hour or something. And they would profile them and figure out, okay, do they have a smartphone or a dumb phone? You know, what's, you know, all sorts of other demographics. So basically you go to a company like that and, you know, tell them, okay, I need to do a survey, you know, and they'll guarantee complete. So, they'll do a screener to figure out the type of people you want. Is it very, very common? Like, okay, anybody with a smartphone? Okay, well, there's 72% of Americans, I believe, at latest count. Is it people with an iPhone, or is it 7-foot-tall Martians
Got
with
it.
iPhones? Well, you can't get a lot of those. But and then from that, then they price whatever the response rate is. So, that's absolutely a key takeaway technique for anybody here who's interested is you really need to get a good quality. And the thing Milman and I always did at our company called Tactics was if you're not in the target buying audience, your opinion just didn't matter. You know, there's absolutely no reason to talk to you, because if you're not going to be buying the product, you know, there's no reason you should have any input in defining it. So anyway, back to Drobo. So we knew complexity was something we wanted to smash out. And we had some ideas on the interface, but how do we do it? Well, as a result of this first survey, we got people to identify if they want to, continue to interact and learn more. So we did we created a mock-up of what the user interface was. So in May or June of the following year, we basically ran that by, I think it was 300 people or so. And our conclusions were we got most things right, but there are a couple things we just got, absolutely wrong, and it could have been fatal. And we learned this, and it got changed, before the product even development was done. And before
are you allowed to tell me what that near fatal decision was? That's okay.
I don't remember. I think it's somewhere turned on how we presented available versus used capacity, because again, Drobo, like a RAID type device, it pools it together. And I think, whatever it was, the original way was probably more technically accurate, and provided richer information, but was just too confusing for people.
Mm.
So that's why it's kind of got boiled down to, it just has sort of, that pie chart that shows you how much is available of whatever the available capacity is.
Okay.
So it's a third full, a quarter full, two thirds full. You can tell just by looking at it, and you don't have, all this other stuff in terms of, you have, this number of terabytes of total raw storage and this amount of terabytes of protected storage and this amount is available. Too much information, too confusing.
Did you, in the early days, I don't remember, did you provide the add-on drives as a prepackaged thing? Is something that the Drobo customer could buy from Drobo, or were they left to go to a internet company and or Amazon or something and buy their own?
No, drive. This is one of the other things we're able to test in research is we're able to identify sort of the our advanced segment, early adopters. Mm-hmm. So we characterize them by both of these variables, and just under a third of them were willing to buy it without drives, which for Drobo was a great win because we could launch right away. They'd buy from Amazon or B&H or drive to their local Fry's, mm-hmm. and just save the company all the time and overhead of building a relationship with a drive company. And then later on, after it launched, about a year later, the company did some great stuff with Western Digital and started offering bundled drives, and that was one of the first dramatic upticks in its sales ramp, because as much as we say it would work with any SATA drive, any 3.5-inch SATA drive, still a little bit of friction. People, is that really sure? Can I use this drive?
So that's it. That's it. You hit the nail on the head. People, you talk to people about one of these naked little SATA drives that comes in an aluminum envelope, and their eyes glaze over, and they go, "I don't know which end is which. I don't know if I bought the right one." Yeah,
that's right. So these are all things that sort of revolutionize it, and if you fast forward Drobo for many years, it's sort of one of its as Drobo started to take off and got well known, Alex Lindsay of the Pixel Core on one of the MacBreak weeklies, he coined this verb, Drobotize, which basically means taking something that's ugly and complex and making it dead simple. That's one of the enduring values at the company today.
Now, one of the cool things about the Drobo is that you've got a very nice, I'll use a geeky term here, RAID 5 system that gracefully allows you to add new drives of different sizes and gracefully expand your capability. You don't have to have all the drives the same size as you used to have to in the past with geekier systems. Did that really help you a lot? I mean, was that a big customer thing? Just swap in a new drive, bigger, faster?
Yes, it was. We did a lot of research as well, survey as well as, focus group, just to really test that concept. And I think we're at the start of, what's now obvious in hindsight, but, drives are becoming bigger, and, cell phones and pocket phones and point and shoot phones are starting to have bigger image sizes. So what used to be maybe a small media collection that would fit on the drive inside your computer, people were just accumulating way, way, way more stuff. And they're starting to see this as a problem because they don't want multiple drives with multiple power supplies and clutter and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think there was a certain amount of luck at that market. And, it was a key technology that Jeff Barrell and his co-founder Julian Terry they created technology that's ultimately now called Beyond RAID, and what it did is it eliminated problems traditional RAID has, which is you need the size of the array is driven by the size of the smallest drive. Well, that makes no sense. Why can't I take a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4 mm-hmm. and a 5 and a 6 and an 8 and a 10 terabyte and just pool them together? Well, that wasn't the way traditional RAID was envisioned, but that was their vision. So, they invented this new technology, and so it allows pooling things together. And a side benefit, or maybe another design goal, depending on how you want to think about it, was that people can add drives at any time, or there's an empty slot, they put a new drive in or pull one out and pull it that 2 terabyte out and replace it with an 8 terabyte, and the storage capacity keeps going up. Very simple. It was revolutionary at the time. Since then, some of the other NAS vendors are starting to do that, with sort of Linux's LVM, but Drobo was the first to do that.
You told me the other day that there came a time when Drobo tried to do something you disagreed with, though.
Yes, I think most boardrooms and board investors, they're like Wall Street investors. They only have two emotions, fear and greed. And, I think after we launched Drobo, it, hit a $40, $45 million a year run rate and after 10 months. And I guess the board decided, well, if we're targeting all these Mac users and creative, imagine if we really go after a real market like SMB. So small, medium business, right? And ultimately, they replaced the CEO with somebody who'd be more amenable to trying to turn the direction of the company. I was there, and after about 6 months, I realized, oh, this is not going to be happy. So I stayed through Macworld of 2011 and then jumped ship and restarted my consulting business, because it was really clear, you know, that Drobo is designed for people who need big storage but don't want to manage it, you know, in the Mac sense. It just works. You know, trying to take that and go into a different market, it nullified all the value propositions, because in the enterprise, they're not afraid of managing RAID arrays. You know, Drobo is a very, very sleek, very simple feature set. Well, in the enterprise, for better or worse, they have sort of this checklist buying behavior where they want every single, you know, they want all sorts of features as long as your arm. And if you don't have one, and this thing, you know, Jeff and I learned, through the Blue Arc experience, if you don't have something like that, companies will be friendly until you grow and mature, until you have some of those things. And if you ultimately get to them, they'll maybe reward you with orders because, okay, you are worthy. And if you don't and you die, well, good thing we didn't waste any money on a, you know, on a failed concept. So it's hitting the enterprise storage and, you know, SMB storage world is a really, really tough game. And we found, again, there's this market for individuals and creatives that was underserved. They needed more than, you know, just what a single hard drive would offer. Right. So it was clear to me that would not work. So so I left, started doing other, redoing my consulting company, did some consulting with some storage companies.
Where you are today?
Well, in the in-between, Jeff Barrell had another idea for another device that, you know, I helped him with. I couldn't join it full time because I had too many other commitments, including a startup venture of my own. But that launched as the Transporter product, and many of your listeners know that.
Oh yes, glorious product.
Yes. So it grew and sold about 17,000 units in the first year, and then it then was clear that Drobo was just hitting too many headwinds and. And Jeff had the opportunity to acquire it. So, acquired it, or Connected Data, the Transporter, parent company, acquired it. You said about, ratifying some of the things that, trying to go into the enterprise or SMB market, the prices got out of whack and everything else. So, he was able to make some changes and sort of, re-trigger growth. And then, Drobo was spun out independently in May of 2015.
Apparently what happens is, and I've seen this over and over again, is you work on something and you develop a passion for it. And the passion for what you're doing creates within you your own kind of vision of where things should go with the technology and with your life. And sometimes you see another bandwagon that accentuates that passion and you jump ship and move on to the next big thing.
Right. And so, sometimes you have an opportunity that you have allegiance that you can help turn things around. So, Drobo's new CEO, Mihir Shah, reached out to me in fall of last year and, said, people keep talking about you, and we got to know each other. And, he's been very much on going back to basics of, since then he's launched about four hardware, updates and three significant software packages in the past 15 months or so. So, Drobo was definitely back on the right track.
Cool. What a great story. Well, you know what? We've been just talking and talking, and here we go, 43 minutes. I think we're going to have to wrap it up. Is there anything you want to close with real quickly?
I have another software imaging venture that is going to be going public with itself early next year. We have a couple early customers who are embedding it, are going to be showing it at the Photo Plus Expo trade show in New York. September, October 20th through 22nd. So if people there have a chance, they should go by and see the ASMP, American Society of Media Photographers booth. as well as in the photo focus booth, a company called Plotograph will be, you know, using some of our viewing and imaging technology. And the venture itself is called Picture, PIQSURE.com.
Cool. We'll look for that. In the meantime, if the listeners would like to contact you and learn more or have questions about what you're doing or products, how's the best way to contact you?
The best way, two ways, is if it's a professional endeavor, contact me through LinkedIn, or just reach out to me in Twitter. I'm at Mark Fuccio, MarkFuccio, all one word, lowercase, Mark Fuccio.
Cool, cool. This has been a delightful discussion, especially the parts about that I liked about, having a vision and moving on and having the courage to leave a company and mark a new path. That was awesome. Thanks for being on the show. I really enjoyed it, Mark.
John, thanks for the invitation, and I enjoyed chatting with you today.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.